everybody, this is Justin Michael Williams with Motivation for Black People, giving you trusted guidance to make your life better. And in this final installment for Black History Month in our series called Forward, I want to bring to you a topic that I think is very close to my heart. But before we begin, I just want to tell you this quick story. So on November 27th, I remember the date like it was yesterday, 2017, I was sitting on my patio to meditate and, you know, like I do almost every morning, but this morning, something was a little bit different because it was so close to the first anniversary of the Trump election. And so I was reflecting on like, wow, it had been an entire year since Donald Trump had been elected as the president of the United States. And I just brought in this centering question back in 2017. And I was asking myself, I said, how can I use my platform and my gifts and my skills and my talents in a way that would really contribute to this movement that we, I think many of us got woken up to in 2016. But I wanted to know how I could contribute in an authentic way, in an authentic way that really felt like it was true to me and resonated with me in the deepest way. And, you know, while I know there are some people who've been out and protesting and fighting for our rights and things for years, you know, I have to be really honest with you guys. I think probably like many people listening, I was kind of in the back seat. You know, I was a backseat activist. I wasn't really using my voice or my platforms really forward facing for this movement. But I think something really powerful happened on that day in 2016. So many of us woke up. And the topic that I'm going to dig into a little bit deeper in this episode with you is the topic of how do we get involved in an authentic way. And it's going to be from a lens that you may not expect, and going to talk to you about really understanding how to get your vision and your values for justice together. We're going to be really strategic here. And it's going to be a special interview with the co-founder of Black Lives Matter, Alicia Garza. So, you know, it was interesting on that day. I'm taking you back to that day in 2017, November 27th, when I was sitting on my patio. And I was asking that question. And you know, when you ask a question in meditation, sometimes you don't hear the answer right away, but sometimes you hear that voice of God or the voice of the universe just hit you. And that's what happened to me that day, kind of like a lightning bolt. I just heard this voice in my head that day, and it just was saying to me, it literally said this exact phrase. It said, 28 days, 28 interviews with 28 young Black creators and leaders who are making history today. The voice was so clear that I knew I was being given some kind of like divine assignment. And so over the next 20 minutes or so, as I continue to meditate, this idea just continued to kind of develop in my mind, in my brain. And it was the way that I describe it to my friends was it felt like somebody plugged like a flash drive into my brain and just downloaded like this entire idea. I was literally seeing every detail, every step, every image. I was even seeing taglines and commercials and a list of potential guests. And the assignment for me that was being given to me by the universe was so clear. It was telling me, start a podcast and release one interview, 28 of them, for every day of Black History Month in the year that was coming, 2018. But the thing was, I was like, okay, this is a really good idea, but is this idea for me? Because I've never done a podcast before. I didn't have any equipment. I wasn't well-connected in the activist community. And to be totally honest with you guys, like I was in this position at that time where I had never really interviewed anybody. People were interviewing me. So I was just like, what? Like, what's going on? And to top it off, remember, I'm having this idea November 27th, and I'm supposed to somehow have 28 interviews by February 1st. But one thing that I know for sure is that when you hear a message that clear, and it kept coming back to me for the next few days, when you hear a message that clear knocking on your door, that is the universe whispering to you with a cue or a hint or like a breadcrumb leading you to a purpose greater than you could ever possibly imagine for yourself. And I love one of the things that Oprah says. Right now, I'm actually in San Francisco getting ready to go to the Oprah 2020 Vision Tour, her tour stop in San Francisco for my birthday. My birthday's February 22nd, so yesterday, depending on when you're listening to this, from when this episode comes out. And one of the things that Oprah says is, you know, one of the greatest gifts of our lives is when we find that flow, we find that flow and that vision for our lives, and that God or the universe has a plan bigger for our lives than we could ever possibly imagine for ourselves. And our job in this life is to find that flow and surrender to it. And I think for me, what I've learned is that when you have those whispers and those clear insights or those moments of intuition and super strong inspiration, like, where does that come from? Where does, you know, when you get that feeling, that charge, like you can't stop thinking about something, you have this huge creative idea come through, like that is a gift from God. That is a gift from the universe. And we cannot take that for granted. And so when those sparks come to me that strong, I always know I have to take action. And so it was through that spark that this podcast, Motivation for Black People, was born in February 1st of 2018. And, you know, it was one of the most fulfilling things I had ever started. And to be totally honest with you guys, my plan originally was just to do the 28 days and stop. But we built such a big community here from all over the world. And then people were like, wait, where are the interviews? Because I stopped in March. And I was like, all right, universe, I'm going to keep going. I'm going to keep showing up. And here we are, Black History Month again, 2 years later, rounding out. And I just want to say thank you guys for being here, whether you're new to this podcast and just starting to listen, or whether you've been here, one of the thousands of people who joined us in our very first month, I just want to thank you and honor you for being on this journey with me and with us, because I really think we as a community, we are growing. We are learning how to get involved. We are learning how to change our lives. We are learning how to transform, and not just for ourselves, but we're learning to do it for the community and for the planet. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is I had the blessing in those first 28 days to interview some of the world's most just incredible thought leaders. I was so blessed to interview people like Terrell Alvin McCraney, who won the Academy Award for his screenplay of Moonlight, and Tarana Burke, who was the founder of the Me Too movement. And you can see this when you scroll way back to our early episodes. But there was one episode that stuck out to me that was very special that I want to share with you guys today, because it was our first ever episode. And the reason it was our first episode is because I felt like it was so important to our movement. And for those of you who, you know, may have not been listening from the beginning or haven't taken this time to scroll all the way back to day one, 2 years ago, I want to end this series forward by going back and playing that first episode with you today. And that episode is with the incomparable Alicia Garza, who is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. And in this episode, she walked us through just the most incredible process. It was such a blessing to kick off this podcast series with her, because I look back and what she did in that episode was she walked us through really a step-by-step process of how to become more engaged, how to become better activists, and not in the way that we see activism being portrayed on social media or how we expect it to look. Because, you know, as our brother Darnell Moore says, who I interviewed on here, it's not about, you know, the raising your fist and holding up the signs and holding up the flags and the reposting. That's the easy part. You know, what about the real activism that I think you guys might be surprised can look a little bit different than you might expect? So without further ado, I'm going to play this episode, our very first episode from the Motivation for Black People podcast, with Alicia Garza, the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Enjoy, and may we remember to wake up the world. Alicia Garza, Alicia, thank you so much for being with me today. I really appreciate your time.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You know what? Everyone, I think, knows and has seen, you know, hashtag Black Lives Matter all around the world. But one of the things that I found really surprising to me was on our Instagram account, Motivation for Black People, sometime a couple months ago, I put up an old interview that you had done describing how Black Lives Matter actually started with the letter and the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I was shocked to hear that, like, so many people commented, they were like, I had no idea. They think of it as this thing that exists without a person behind it. So, if you're willing, I would love for you to tell the listeners this incredible story about how this kind of all came to birth into the world.
Sure. I mean, I only have a few minutes, so there's a much longer story that I think is an important one, which really starts after Hurricane Katrina and really is a kind of mass consciousness moment for Black people. That Black people aren't safe in this country, right? We had Black people on roofs and, in boats, right? And on bridges, waving white t-shirts and saying, we need our government to help us, and our government refused. That moment really opened up a whole lot of awareness around the ongoing systemic inequality that Black communities in this country, really around the world, but here in the US in particular, face. And Black Lives Matter really comes to be after Trayvon Martin was murdered, and then subsequently his killer, George Zimmerman, was acquitted in his murder. And for many of us, Trayvon's case was not actually something that was in people's consciousness until there were groups like the Dream Defenders and BYP 100 and Freedom Side, right, who essentially took over the state capitol
Right.
in protest of his killer's acquittal. But prior to that, if it wasn't for those organizations, we really wouldn't have known Trayvon's name because the district attorney in that case had previously chosen not to press charges. So Black Lives Matter really emerges from this moment of collective grieving and anguish over how a 17-year-old child could be murdered and his killer could get away with it under the law. And so when George Zimmerman was acquitted, I, like many other people who were following the trial, watching the trial, and really thinking that there was going to be some level of accountability given how clean and clear-cut the case seemed, were really shocked and felt like we'd been punched in the gut when he was acquitted under Florida's Stand Your Ground laws. And so part of my reaction to that was to write a love letter to Black people in a moment of collective anguish and grief. And my sister Patrice put a hashtag in front of Black Lives Matter. And my sister Opal then helped us create some of the online infrastructure that we thought would be useful to connect people like us who were angry, who were upset, who were grieving, but also needed to do that in community and translate that grief and that anger into an act of love, which is how I understand what organizing is. And so that's really the short story of how
Yeah.
Black Lives Matter came to
No,
be.
it's beautiful. And I think one of the things that really like my body got like goosebumps on it again when you say it is that your reaction to everything that happened was to write a love letter. That is always really touching to me because I remember when all of this was going on and there was so much anger and so much grief going on. And can you talk to me just about that internal process for you? And like transmuting that into a love letter, like how did that happen internally in your own way?
I've been organizing in Black communities for a long time. And so in some ways, I think part of what bubbled up in me that very night was actually kind of like long remnants of that same grief that I've experienced in communities that lose children before they're born, and it never makes even the local news.
Right.
And honestly, one of the things that really struck me about the reactions that people were having to George Zimmerman's acquittal was that it was varied, right? So
Yeah.
on the one hand, you had some more conservative members of our communities saying things like, this is a tragedy, this never should have happened, George Zimmerman shouldn't have walked free. But then their conclusion on how to stop it was to make sure that our kids don't wear hoodies or that they don't sag their pants. And
Totally.
in fact, you saw laws in places like Oklahoma that tried to ban the wearing of hoodies. And so it was really a response from our own community that was about blaming ourselves. for conditions that we didn't create. Then there was this piece from what I call the social justice warriors, right? Which are folks who are kind of like too woke for our own good, where people are essentially saying things like, oh, now you're mad. You know, this has been happening forever, but now you're mad and you thought you were going to get justice from this system and this, that, and the other thing. And I feel that, right? I mean, I'm also somebody who's not unaware of how unjust the criminal justice system is. And at the same time, I just kept thinking about Trayvon's mother. And if she had been reading those posts, what would she have felt, right? So there was something about wanting to love on us in a moment where, you know, it felt like collectively we were being attacked, but it also felt like we were attacking each other from within. And so Black Lives Matter and that love letter was really an opportunity for me to just get out. Like, it's not that there's something wrong with us. It's that we exist in a system that's wrong. And so that's what we need to fight. And in order to do that, we really need to love up on each other so that we collectively can be powerful enough to transform the systems that rob us of our dignity.
This is so powerful. This is so powerful. And I think, you know, it's so interesting. Like, I feel those two sides of the equation always happening, like the too woke for your own good side and the conservative side happening all the time. And, you know, I remember even I was thinking back to when I was younger and like I, you know, in college, I went to UCLA where there was like my year that I went to school, there was 82 Black people in a 6,000 person class, you know, and you know, I would be like, I had that concept of like, well, if I'm preppy enough, if I look fine enough, everything's going to be okay, you know, and then recognizing this one day, I was walking home from my dorm room and had a hoodie on, which I was just coming from the gym, and the police stopped me and asked me for my school ID, you know, and this was 3 years in. I'd walked that route every single day. And I thought, you know what? And that's when I switched sides. It's like, this, I'm not exempt. No one is exempt from this, no matter what rules we change, no matter how we dress, no matter how we do anything. It's like, we don't need to change. And that's, I don't know. Right. I just feel like the way that you've put that, though, and transmuted that into let's love who we are and how we really are and not try to adjust, that makes this whole movement so powerful.
Absolutely. Thank you for saying that.
Yeah, no, it's so real for me. And I think, you know, the next thing that I wanted to ask you really is, when it's about making movements and creating waves, like what I love from this was really birthed, this whole project, out of just real passion for what was going on. And I feel like so many people, even including myself, have been in the position of like, I want to do something, even in my own community. I want to create something that's going to help people, that's going to make change within even just the friends and the circles that I'm in. What are some of the ways that you have found that are effective for people to even learn to start to get involved in the movement in more than just like a passive, you know, I'm listening kind of way, but in an actually active and engaging way?
That's a really great question. I mean, the first thing I think that feels really important to me is just getting clear on what you care about. We live in a time where we're both being told that we're apathetic. And in a lot of ways, because we have so much information coming at us all the time, we can be apathetic, right? It can be really overwhelming. And so one of the things I try to say to people is like, take time to figure out what is it that you're really passionate about and why, right? Because you're going to have to go back to that. If you really decide that you want to change how things are, it's not always going to be easy, and there's going to be times, a lot of times, when you want to give up. And so you have to be able to go back to that, why am I in this, and what does it mean for me, and what can I imagine how the world would be different if I was successful. The second thing that feels really important is to find a team. And you know, the way that we're taught about history, whether it be, you know, the last period of civil rights or women's suffrage or whatever it is we're taught that there's these kind of charismatic individuals that then, you know, sparked an entire larger group of people to then make change. And actually, that's not totally how change happens. yes, there are charismatic leaders that do inspire people to join the movement, but they in and of themselves are not the movement.
Right.
And so any leader that you've ever heard of, whether it be Malcolm X, whether it be Martin Luther King, whether it be Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, whether it be Septima Clark, right? All of these people had teams, and these are folks that they made plans with, that they dreamed together with, that they strategized with, and they're also people that held them accountable. Mm-hmm. And so it's really important to kind of shed this notion that once you put on your cape, you become Superman and you're going to change the world. That's not actually how change happens. And so part of what we've got to figure out is, how do we learn to work with other people and decenter the individual and really prioritize what it means to be working in a collective or collaboratively?
Yeah.
And then the third thing that I would offer is to really understand history and do the critical reading of history, not the kind of sanitized versions that we get. So one of the things that I see a lot is part of where the cynicism comes from, but also part of where I think our understanding of how change happens gets impacted, is that we really haven't done a lot of studying of, you know, well, for movements that came before us, what were some of the big challenges that they faced? What were some of the methods that they used? What were some of the things that they tried and that didn't work? How were women and queer people treated in these movements, right?
Yeah.
And once we start to understand that, we learn lessons that we realize we don't have to repeat. We get to make new mistakes. But one of the things that I see, particularly right now, is that sometimes we have a politic that is about blackness that's not actually about equality, and it's also not about equity or transformation.
Mm.
It really gets stuck in this narrative of, we were once kings and queens, and so that's what we're trying to return to. And so really the thing to do is just hunker in with our own people and try to build something in isolation of everything that's going on around us. And my short warning to that would be, that's also not how change happens, and certainly not sustainable long-term change. So knowing our history and knowing some of the challenges that people who tried to change the world before us encountered also helps us orient ourselves to what does that mean for the world that we live in today.
This is really good. I want to actually unpack that last thing you said a little bit. I'm so glad you said this, because you're the first person that I'm interviewing who has been just like so forward about talking about this idea of blackness versus equality. If you're willing, I would love to unpack that a little bit more and your thoughts on that and kind of what you're seeing in the world right now, because I do feel that there is a difference. I'm finding that there's a difference between like a pro-black movement and like you said, a movement that's really leaning towards being pro-black plus equality. So what have you seen in these spaces that people, that might open people's minds into the history of what's happened there or even what's happening now that might be problematic?
Uh-huh. These are good questions. Well, one major thing that I see is that blackness gets reduced to Christian, heterosexual, middle to upper class blackness. And we leave a lot of people behind in that way, right? So, and also there's a challenge in saying that that's what we're aspiring to be when, as you said earlier, it actually doesn't matter if you're rich like Oprah. Oprah gets racially profiled just like a D-boy on the corner gets racially profiled, right? So it's not about class ascendancy, right? It's not about making more money, because making more money doesn't actually shield you from the systemic nature of white supremacy, which essentially elevates everything white and it denigrates everything that is not white, which includes blackness, but it is not solely restricted to it. And so to make that plain, I think one of the big challenges that I keep seeing rear its ugly head is that in moments where there is momentum around generating and activating people in the service of our collective transformation. Often people fall back on tropes that we've been told or ingrained with, sometimes unconsciously, right? So one great example is that this movement is very much powered by women, by queer people, by trans people, by Black people who are immigrants and not born here in the United States. And yet the common narratives about who are the quote unquote leaders of this movement continue to go towards those who are straight, those who are male, and those who are Christian, right? And so it's not to denigrate any of those things. It's to say we deserve a Blackness that is more complex than what we've been flattened into.
Yes.
And in movements prior to ours, these were always the challenges. When you look at what happened with SNCC and CORE, which were, you know, civil rights organizations in the last period of civil rights, they had some of these same challenges, right? When you look at what was happening with Bayard Rustin and Martin Luther King, I mean, politics aside, that's a whole other conversation to have. Bayard couldn't really play a public role because he was gay and because that was unacceptable in terms of Blackness. And so I would honestly say that part of what I would love all of us to keep thinking about, like, is it all Black people or just some Black people? And if it's all Black people, then we really have to challenge ourselves to talk about what is the role of our individual beliefs about how we might live our own lives in a broader process of how we want to change our conditions collectively. So there's that piece. And then there's also a piece that feels important to me, which really just fits in, what is it that we're really fighting for? Now, if you're a student of history, then one thing that you know is that the last period of civil rights and even Black power to some extent really got absorbed into the existing structures of the state and of government. And part of where a lot of people will, who were involved very deeply at that time, part of where folks have a lot of reflection is that they'll say, you know, we were so excluded from the structures of power that in some ways our demands got limited to just having a seat at the table. And what we missed, right, was being able to make the rules. Okay.
Right.
And so you can sit at somebody else's table and play under somebody else's rules and your situation won't really change.
Right.
Right. But if you are making the rules, okay, then that's a whole different ballgame. And so that's something that I think is important for us to think about as we also continue to grapple with, is it all Black people or just some Black people? Now, last thing I'll say quickly is that, what we also know is that the biggest missed opportunities in the history of this country have always been the ones in which we had opportunities to align with other communities who were being oppressed. And whether that was Chinese laborers who built the railroads to Chinese immigrants today, whether that be indigenous peoples whose land and resources were stolen and who the United States attempted a genocide.
Yeah.
We've missed opportunities to align with those communities, right? Or whether it even be, you know, working class white people during emancipation, right? Who were also being freed in some ways, right? From the system of chattel slavery,
yeah.
Right? There were incredible missed opportunities for alignment that could have resulted in a larger people's movement that fought to change the rules and to make decisions about what the rules were. And so it can't just be Black people for Black people. And some people do have that analysis, right? That what they really want to do is just build a nation for Black people. And I'm not knocking that because the most revolutionary versions of that theory also take into account that we don't live here by ourselves.
Right.
And that we are, in fact, though many of us were stolen from our homelands, right? We have common cause, right, with other people who are being stolen from, and who, for whom the United States has its boot on their neck. And at the same time, we've got to be very mindful that Blackness in and of itself is not sufficient as a vision for social change. Just like queerness in and of itself is not sufficient for a vision of social change, right? That we have to be nimble and complex enough to really weave together our experiences and our histories if we really want to reshape what our future looks like.
Yes. Oh my gosh. Girl, preach to me, please. I can just sit here and listen to you talk about this all day. As you're talking about this, one of the things that's coming through my mind, and I know that I feel like I understand the answer to this question, but I'm sure people are probably thinking, with a movement with a name like Black Lives Matter, right? And then with the context of what you're talking about being in alignment with other communities and the movement not being just about Black people, but about togetherness and unity. Can you speak to what the real message and why, which is, you know, one of your main three tips, like what is the real meaning and purpose of Black Lives Matter if it is not indeed just focused on Black people? I'm curious on where you stand with that, or just to give people the real full tea straight from you.
Yeah, of course. So the real purpose of Black Lives Matter is to end anti-Black racism and state-sanctioned violence, and to build a world where Black people and all people can live in their full dignity, period. So it is not the purpose of Black Lives Matter is essentially to ensure a better world for all of us, which is where the All Lives Matter camp really drives me nuts, because there's a way in which we can use this notion of unity and togetherness in a way that erases, or at the very least, sets to the side the very root of the reason why people are not together and people are not unified.
Right.
And it's not just a matter of individual agency. It's also very much baked into the foundation of this country. So that's why we talk about anti-Black state-sanctioned violence, because what we know in this country is that Black people can be murdered in a number of different ways under the law. And that is what we aim to change. But also, it's not just about fighting against, right? It's about the process of creating what it is that we want to see instead. And so Black Lives Matter simultaneously is envisioning a new future where we all can live in dignity.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so, like, as you're saying this, I guess what I'm feeling is, and tell me if this is right, is that in the acknowledgement and recognition that it is Black Lives Matter, we're acknowledging that this is the reason why the problem started in the first place. And the goal is so that all of us, not just one side of us, can live with our full dignity and power and purpose. Right? Is that explaining
it? Absolutely.
Oh, okay, great.
That's exactly what it is.
I think it's beautiful. You know, and I remember hearing, or I think it was some little video on Facebook or something that had explained it so well. You probably know where I'm talking about, where it said, there was like a house that was burning down, and it was like, our house matters, like help our house. And then some other people standing outside were saying, well, all houses matter, but yours is the one that's on fire. So let's ignore that. And I thought that
that's
was a really good picture of kind of what's going on in the world. We can't ignore the places that are on fire. Right. It's just like, well,
that's exactly right.
Amazing. I have another question for you. When people are looking to really start to create movement, and you spoke a little bit to this, but I'm wondering more on like a personal level, as individuals, when people are looking to get involved in a movement, or even join, like you said, one of your tips was to find a team, but even to join a team that already exists, what do you think is the number one thing that's blocking young Black people from getting involved in a way? What do you find is the biggest thing that's stopping people from moving?
I think it's a few things. One is, I think that one of the things that keeps us from moving together is that we don't believe that change is possible. We think in some ways that this is the way it's always going to be, and that really what we've just got to do is save ourselves, right? So just the other day I was visiting my godchild, who's now 7 weeks old. And, you know, I got a chance to take their mama out for the night. She hadn't been out in a while. And we met somebody who, you know, was a Black dude who said, you know, I just don't vote because I don't believe in these parties and I don't believe in these politicians. And so the only thing I can do is improve myself. Now, I understand that. And certainly there is a deep corruption that exists with the two-party system. And at the same time, I think it is important to say, well, what is the consequence, right, of not engaging at all, right? In an arena where millions and millions and millions and millions of people engage in order to have their voices heard. and maybe the problem isn't so much maybe the problem isn't so much just the system itself. Maybe the problem is a lack of imagination and a lack of belief on our own part that we can change our own circumstances. And I think that that lack of belief comes from a deep disappointment in what we have experienced in our lives.
Right.
So not to shame people for feeling that way. I feel that way sometimes. And I know that no change has happened ever in the history of this country, at least, by people just deciding they're going to take care of themselves. If Harriet Tubman had did that, right, we'd be in a very different place than we are today. The second thing I think really gets in the way is that people have a deep distrust of organizations. And some of the reasons for that are incredibly valid, right? As many organizations that we've had that have really helped to catalyze our communities towards a new kind of change, we've also had organizations in our communities that unfortunately have taken advantage of the challenges that we face, have really looked, instead of creating change, they've really looked on an organizational level to create change only for themselves or for their particular crew. And that hurts us too, right? That definitely hurts us too. So when we have organizations that claim to serve Black people that, you know, take money from places like Walmart or from Philip Morris, right? Or when we have Black organizations that, for example, lobby against things like net neutrality, this is enough to create a deep distrust in our communities that change is possible. And so in some ways, what my grandma would say is that some of these organizations are doing the devil's work without a request.
Oh, that is good. Grandma had that one on point.
What I would say to that is it's important for us to find a place that we feel really represents our values while understanding that no organization has the blueprint to get to where we need to be. We need a lot of different kinds of blueprints.
This is beautiful. And I think the values piece, as you were talking about that, that's the piece that I was really feeling into, because the values are that's kind of the thing that doesn't change, right? Some of the structures can change. Some of the how we're doing stuff can change. But I feel like once we have our real deep-rooted values, I don't know, sometimes I feel like those things are immovable at least in a short period of time for people. Aligning that with an organization could help create that trust. Do you feel like it can help create the trust as long as you feel like your values align with the organization that you're becoming a part of?
I do feel like it can help create that trust. And again, we shouldn't mistake the role of organizations to be to serve every need and address every concern we've ever had, right? any organization that purports to do that is not telling you the truth,
right? Right?
Including BLM. Like, we don't purport to solve everybody's problems or, you know, make people's lives better on the immediate tip. And we also don't purport to know all the answers. What we know is that our role is to connect people and to build their capacity to be able to fight another day, right? Yeah. And there are tons of organizations out there that have different roles to play, whether it be policy change and legislative change, whether it be electoral organizing, whether it be organizing in faith-based communities, whether it be organizing with youth. I mean, there's so many ways to get involved. And so again, going back to what we talked about earlier, knowing your passion and your vision for what change looks like will help you align yourself with an organization that fits your values and that fits your vision.
That's perfect. That's so perfect. I think that's the big piece. As you said it right at the time that I was flipping back over to the notes I was taking about your three, was just that first point is like, what are you passionate about? Because there's so many. And I think that's where a lot of us get overwhelmed with, like, which direction do I want to take to help? But if we just go back into a self-reflexive state and just ask ourselves, what am I actually passionate about in this movement as a person, even caring about all of it, but knowing that which one like lights me up the most, and then kind of searching in that direction might help us find, those of us who have been looking for a way to get involved, find an easier route to finding an organization to become a part of. Thank you so much for that, Alicia. I have one more question for you, and this is a surprise question, but one that I also ask everyone. If you could look back and have a conversation with your younger self, you can go back to any age that you want, but I want to think about the Alicia before she was the leader of any movement. And if you could talk to yourself, knowing everything that you know now, and give yourself one piece of advice, what would that advice be?
So today, what I would say is trust your own compass. So, you know, if I could say to myself in a younger, my younger self, what do you need to be successful today? And it's something I still struggle with. It's like, you know, there's a lot of critics without credentials. So trust your own compass and keep moving.
Trust your own compass and keep moving. And I love that. There's a lot of critics without credentials. That reminds me of something my grandma used to always say, where she used to just be like, you don't ask somebody who's broke for advice about money. You know what I mean?
Like, hello.
Don't ask, like, hello. You know, so just like, you don't ask somebody who ain't got a man about how to be in a good relationship. Like, you just don't ask these questions.
Baby,
so there's these critics without the credit.
Entire truth.
Right?
See? You know what? This is why we got to listen to Black women. Because we
know
a little something.
Yes, grandma's coming through. Anyways, Alicia, thank you so, so much for your time and your wisdom
thank
and
you.
For everything that you're doing. I just want to make sure for everyone listening who wants to know more or get more involved with Black Lives Matter specifically, what's the best way for them to get in touch or look something up for you?
Yeah. Well, you can check out our website, which is www.blacklivesmatter.com. Or you can also send us an email, info@blacklivesmatter.com. And then we've got chapters in 40 places. There's a chapters list on the website, which should give you some info on how to contact folks. But certainly, you know, you can still participate in the movement, even if you're not a part of our network. So, you know, if Black Lives Matter isn't exactly your thing, then let's keep talking about leaning into what you care about the most and being able to build a team that reflects that care and those values.
Amazing. Oh my gosh. I hope you guys enjoyed that. I just listened back to that episode and I get like the feels. You can probably hear it in my voice for those of you guys who've been listening. Like, that was one of my first interviews, like interviewing somebody. And so what a long way it's come. And I get all the feels listening to that, because Alicia really provided a roadmap for us, you know, to get clear on our values for change and then see how we can get involved. And there are so many different ways. And I think one of the keys is remembering that we don't need to get overwhelmed, right? There's so many things to be involved in, but just to choose something and to get started. And as we talk about, you know, in this series, all about moving forward, I think there's no way to move forward if we're not taking action. And hopefully this episode inspired you to do that. So, you know, on this Black History Month, we've done so much. We've talked about wellness in our different episodes, you know, especially looking at last week with Reclaiming Wellness with Nicole Cardoza. If you haven't listened to that, it's really incredible, talking about how we can define healthy for ourselves so that we can break these cycles, you know, and really bringing some awareness to mental health and all the different things in our lives. You guys know that I love this on this podcast. And, you know, other things that I might even point you to that were not discussed just in this particular month that I think are important to us moving forward holistically is looking at how we get out of debt and take charge of our finances. And so you might look back to episode 104 that we did with the Budgetnista, who it just was an incredible episode that we did right before the holidays about being stressed about money, but it's something that you can use all year long. And I think getting our money right, getting them coins right, is going to be a big part of us moving forward as individuals and as a community. And then, you know, if you haven't listened to our episode with Sean King, which is episode 111, you can go scroll back and just check that out a couple episodes ago. It's what we kicked off this series forward with. I definitely invite you to check that out because he talked to us about two of the most important issues to pay attention to this election season. And, you know, there's so many things that we're seeing on the news and we're getting totally overwhelmed by and bombarded with all the stuff that's happening in the media. It's hard to know what to focus on. And Sean King really broke it down for us with what to pay attention to so that you can cut through and break through the noise so that we can win this cycle big time. So, without further ado, I just want to say thank you. I love you. I honor you. It is such a privilege to be on this journey with you for 2 years going strong now, and we ain't stopping soon. We ain't stopping soon. We are just getting started. I love you. I thank you. I honor you. And if you haven't done so already, and especially if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, I would just invite you to take just a quick second right now to rate this podcast and leave a comment. Because this really, it seems insignificant, but it really makes a big difference in our ability to get the word out to as many people, as many of our people as possible. So just flip open your phone, rate the season, comment on the podcast, and I read all of them. So I love to hear your guys' messages and see the things that you're feeling and what you're loving about being with us in this community. So I will talk to you on the next episode, and this has been Justin Michael Williams. Bye for now.